Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist entity is a long-standing signatory to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it continues to flout the very principles of the declaration to which it's supposedly committed. Article 9, for example, is unequivocal. It states that no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention or exile. Yet last year alone, the Israeli regime subjected more than 2,000 Palestinians to arbitrary administrative detention orders. And as we've previously reported on Palestine Declassified, the conditions in Israeli prisons are appalling. Palestinian prisoners have little or no legal recourse, so many of them have engaged in hunger strikes as a form of resistance. One of those was Qada Adnan. And Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about his heroic struggle for Palestinian liberation and his ultimate sacrifice after an 87-day-long hunger strike.
A giant has moved on. Khadr Adnan, a father, baker, mathematician and spokesman for the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, has died after 87 days of hunger strike in an Israeli dungeon. He launched his protest against his administrative detention by resisting the natural human urge to consume food. Born on March 24, 1978, in the town of Arrabi, close to the Palestinian city of Jenin, Adnan came to age as a much-loved member of his family. His first arrest in his early 20s by the Israeli occupation forces led to 4 months' imprisonment. The very same year, he was arrested by the Palestinian Authority for leading a student demonstration against the visit of pro-Israel French Prime Minister Lionel Jospin to his university, Bir Zeit in Ramallah. Khadr gained a degree in mathematics and went on to own a bakery, where he provided the people of Jenin with sustenance. The irony is that one who provided food to others would later go on to be known for using his own hunger as a tool of emancipation. Across his life of struggle, Khadr Adnan was arrested 12 times. Many of those times, he was held for lengthy periods without any charge in what is commonly referred to as administrative detention. It is believed that around 800 Palestinians are also held on such a basis throughout the network of dungeons in the Israeli matrix of unfreedom squatting over Palestine. His arrest by Israeli occupation forces on December 17, 2011, led to his first 66-day hunger strike, which at the time broke the record for the longest by any Palestinian political prisoner. The settler colonial agents took him from his home, where his pregnant wife and 2 daughters lived with him. During that arrest, he was interrogated for 18 days and said to have been tortured by Israeli intelligence. But the spirit of Khadr Adnan was not broken, and he held his hunger strike, demanding his release from administrative detention. The strike was successful and led to his release in February 2012. Later that year, following the Israeli forces' assassination of Palestinian revolutionary thinker Basil al-A'raj, Khadr Adnan condemned the treachery of the Palestinian Authority, stating that those who assisted Israel in the killing of the martyr Basil were in fact worse than the occupation itself. The last time he was detained on administrative detention in 2023, his three-month hunger strike would lead to his death. He fought with everything he had for the liberation of his people, and with his steadfast perseverance, he has written his name in the stars.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeym University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is Yusuf Al-Halou, who is from Gaza and joins us via Skype. Yusuf is a Palestinian commentator, and over the last 15 years, he's worked as a broadcast news correspondent for various international media outlets. His output has been featured on media channels all over the world, including the Real News Network in the US, the BBC in the UK, and TV New Zealand, among many others. Welcome to the show. Yusuf, I wonder if you could start with you. I mean, how has the death of Khadr Adnan in an Israeli jail been received by Palestinians?
Thank you for having me. Well, it was received with anger, frustration, and sadness because we lost a Palestinian figure. We lost a Palestinian icon who caused havoc to Israel because of his steadfastness and high morale. He was an icon of hope because he was released. He forced Israeli prison services to release him. He was arrested, rearrested. He took part in the hunger strike many times. So, and also Palestinian resistance movements in Gaza, the West Bank, also they reacted angrily and they responded by retaliating. Khadr Adnan will remain in our collective memory for generations to come. His family vowed that they will continue the path. His children, from where he came from Jenin in the West Bank, obviously it was a very sad moment, but he raised the spirit of other Palestinian inmates.
I mean, David, tell us about Jenin, where Khadr Adnan was from. I mean, what's its significance in the latest uprising?
Well, it's been very significant. I mean, Jenin has been a significant place in the occupied territories for decades now. But it's right in the north of what's called the West Bank, quite close to Nablus, which has been another epicentre of the resistance there. And the Jenin brigades, new brigades have emerged there, along with things like the Lion's Den in Nablus. And these are new armed groups which have bring together all the different factions. So Hamas on the one hand, the PIJ, which Adnan was a member of, and then some of the leftist factions, but also members of Fatah, which runs the Palestinian Authority, which is divided down the middle on these questions. And so that Fatah members from the Al-Aqsa Brigade, which is the armed wing of Fatah, have been joining in these missions. So this is a very important area for the renewed resistance which is happening in the territories and which is leading to the possibility of full-scale conflict.
Mm. Yusuf, what can you tell us about Adnan's victorious hunger strike in 2012?
Well, he served the longest hunger strike at the time, and of course it was celebrated because he succeeded in gaining his freedom temporarily before he passed away. He was allowed to die slowly in his prison cell because of negligence. He posed as a beacon of hope. He raised the spirit and morale of other Palestinian hunger strikers. And of course, he was praised highly by the Palestinian people, even by non-Palestinians. His image, his photo, is almost in the memory and mind of every Palestinian and every freedom fighter. Adnan was a beacon of hope. He was a beacon of, and we sadly lost him, but we will not forget him.
I mean, David, tell us about the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, which, you know, Adnan was a significant part of, wasn't he?
So in addition to Hamas, which is probably the best known resistance group, there, of course, is other resistance groups. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is more Islamic and perhaps even more Islamic than Hamas, if that's possible. Mm. And then there are the more secular leftist groups like the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, various factions associated with them. Now, PIJ is particularly closely related to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they are supported by Iran, although, of course, Iran supports all of the resistance groups, and that's, of course, the case with with other states roundabout who are supporting the resistance axis, like the Syrians, for example. The Syrians, public on record, are saying it doesn't matter what words you have in the name of your organisation, Syria supports you, by which it means that it will support what are seen as Islamic groups in the West, seen as Islamist groups, that racist term that's used for anyone the Muslim world who takes up politics and thinks of religion as part of that process. So PIJ is a very important element here, and it's been seen as a key target for the Israelis. They see it as a threat, and they've tried to divide off the PIJ from Hamas and from the other groups, and that's not working.
No, indeed. I wonder whether, as well, you might sort of give us your impression about the latest Israeli assassination campaign against the PIJ as well.
Well, I mean, that isn't the key thing. Is that they're trying to say to the resistance, well, you know, you can split, we'll try and split you, and of course the whole way in which resistance is now operating in the West Bank, especially, is to have to dispense with the differences between the different organisations and the formation of the Lions Den, or the Janine Brigade, or the Falcon's Nest, a whole series of new resistance groups are groups which purposefully dissolve the barrier between these different factions, and they all fight together. And they all fight together in the localities where they are, in Janine or in Nablus, but also increasingly they are coordinating across the whole of the West Bank and indeed with Gaza. We know already, of course, that there is coordination outside the territories in Beirut, for example, where the Iranians and Hezbollah and Hamas and other resistance leaders coordinate on actions throughout the territory. So we're seeing an increased coordination on the ground and throughout the region, which is, of course, a huge threat to Israel, and that's why they want to split off different parts of the resistance from each other.
Indeed. I mean, Yusuf, Israel is currently bombing Gaza yet again. As a Palestinian journalist living in Britain with family in Gaza, I wonder whether you could give us a sense of what's that like?
Well, Gaza is the world's largest open-air prison, and Israel uses Gaza as a testing ground for its advanced weapons. The rockets and the bombs Israel uses to target different locations across Gaza creates loud explosions and shakes the ground. It's a terrible situation, scary. There's no safe place in Gaza. My family, the rest of the 2 million people, we have been experiencing this psychological issue for more than 15 years since Israel waged its first major offensive on Gaza in late 2008. So weapons, tanks, shells, drones fly constantly in the sky of Gaza. Incursions take place, the besieging of Gaza. All these measures constitute psychological problems, and people see their loved ones killed, maimed, children torn apart. Last night, 4 children were killed. Families were targeted while they were asleep in their houses. So it's unbelievable situation. People in Gaza, they have no normal life. It's abnormal situation. The siege has been blockaded since 1967. The airspace of Gaza has been blockaded, since the occupation of the Palestinian territories. The land border crossings are also restricted and controlled by Israel. So Israel controls what goes inside Gaza. Israel controls what happens in Gaza. It carries out airstrikes. It's disproportionate force used against defenseless civilian population. So whenever there is an airstrike in Gaza, or tank shelling, or bombardment, obviously I become worried. I contact my family, but they tell me it has become the norm. Can you imagine? The suffering has become daily part of their lives.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have our solidarity, Yusuf. But we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got another report now about the history of Palestinian hunger strikes in the Israeli dungeon network.
The Israeli dungeon network, which deepens Palestinian on freedom, is vast and sprawling. It is believed that close to 5,000 Palestinians are held in the occupiers' cells, with almost 200 of them children and almost 50 of them women. Within that context, the battle of empty stomachs is a tactic some Palestinians have been known to use as a method of protesting their enslavement. The first collective hunger strikes following the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza took place in 1969 in Ramla and Kafr Yonah jails. Palestinians refused to eat for 11 days. protesting against the orders to address Israeli jailers with the words, "Yes, sir." They were also expressing their opposition to the bad quality food in the occupation dungeons. Palestinian women in Israeli jails had to go on hunger strike for 9 days in order to obtain sanitation supplies. So much for women's rights. Israel also has a history of force-feeding Palestinian prisoners who are on hunger strike. This has led to death in several cases, and the United Nations condemned it as tantamount to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Despite that, Israel passed legislation in 2015 that legalized the force-feeding of prisoners on hunger strike. The longest Palestinian hunger striker on record is Samir Issawi of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Famous for his resistance during the Second Intifada, Samir was treacherously rearrested by Israel following a prisoner swap. He then undertook a gargantuan 266-day hunger strike in which he survived on only intravenous vitamins and minerals. Israel feared that his death in prison would spark riots and released him in 2013. Even an empty Palestinian stomach is a threat to the fragile squatter entity.
Yusuf, what can you tell us about the history of hunger strikes in the Palestinian struggle?
Well, the Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners, they adopted the Irish experience to live on water and salt. I'm aware of what happened at those times. So it's a means to pressure the Israeli prison authorities to respond to their demands, which are obviously to release them from Israeli prisons and detention centers and to stop the sudden storming of their prison rooms, and also to bring those in the cells to the normal prison rooms, and also to return the confiscated devices such as phones, TV, radio, and also to allow family visitations. So it's, can you imagine, it's like basic human rights. They are demanding for their rights inside the prisons. So they adopted this in the past 15 years, starting with a female prisoner in the 90s, and then in 2010, 12. So it's been going on for the past, let's say, 25 years, but it made headlines with hunger strike of Khadr Adnan and Samir Issawi and a female prisoner. So with the death of Khadr Adnan, I don't think hunger strike will stop. I think Israel wanted to scare Palestinian hunger strikers. So I'm sure we will witness more hunger strikes. And let's not forget the mass hunger strike that took place in 2022, when over 1,000 Palestinian political prisoners, they performed and took part in this campaign. Palestinian political prisoners are denied their rights inside Israeli prisons, and they demand their release. About 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners and detainees, including children, women, have been living in miserable conditions inside Israeli jails and detention centers.
Yeah. I mean, David, of course, many supporters in the north of Ireland have spoken out in support, haven't they, of Khadr Adnan? I mean, how do you think the Irish hunger strikes actually link to the Palestinian ones?
Well, we just heard there that example of the Irish question was an inspiration to the Palestinian Indeed. Prisoners. And of course it was an inspirational thing because of the use of the tactic of hunger and how it broke open the political opportunities for political advancement. Now, in the case of Ireland, what happened was there was a no-wash protest. Prisoners were not allowed to go to the bathroom, no. To the toilet, without wearing prison uniform, which they refused to do. And so they were forced to smear their cells as a result, including women prisoners in Armagh prison, who, of course, didn't have access to sanitation rights, much like the Palestinian women Indeed. Who went on strike for such rights. The women prisoners in our jail didn't have sanitation. They had to smear their blood on their own cell walls. And that led, of course, when that didn't work, to the hunger strikes. Mm. And eventually, Bobby Sands, who we see on the wall there, died after a long time on hunger strike on the 5th of May 1981, just over 42 years ago now. And, of course, there's an inspiration there for much of the struggle across Palestine and indeed across West Asia. I was in Tehran just the other day, and famously when you go to the British Embassy in Tehran, the street was renamed by the government there as Bobby Sands Street, as a nod to the struggle of the Irish Republicans. And that there's a real sense in Palestine of the importance of the Irish struggle, and indeed, of course, in the north of Ireland, with a real sense of the importance of the Palestinian struggle. And people in Ireland at that time, and still now, look to the Palestinians as a model and in terms of solidarity.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Youssef, I wonder whether you can tell us about this practice of administrative detention that the Israeli regime uses against Palestinians.
Well, it's a technique to continuously detain Palestinians up to 6 months, and after each 6 months, it's renewed automatically without the need for evidence. This is the problem. So you can be locked indefinitely forever without the need to go to court. This is according to Israel's mentality that this is what's meant by the administrative detention. You are kept inside the prison even if you didn't plead guilty, even if there were no evidence. This is the thing. It's against international law, of course, and the world is watching and stands idle. I think it's to do with the international conspiracy of silence. You know, there are many red lines were crossed by Israel. I mean, if you think about it, why would Israel bear the burden of keeping Palestinian political prisoners and locking them? It's a way to draw an example of punishment. This will be your fate if you dare to criticize Israel, or let's say if you dare to conduct yourself in military activities or resistance activities. Around, as I mentioned, around 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being killed. Sometimes it drops, sometimes it increases. It's a way to break the morale and the will of the Palestinians. God knows what happens for children. You know, there's many children are lost their childhood, especially Ahmed, a Palestinian boy who lost his childhood and he was interrogated, he was beaten. So this interrogation system, psychologically, the beating, the denial of family visitation, the renewal of administrative detention, it's all measures designed to allow Israel to do whatever it wants without being held accountable.
Yeah. I mean, David, you just spoke a moment ago there about the kind of parallels between the, you know, the Palestinian struggle and the Irish struggle. I mean, whether you could, now could say something about the links between British settler colonialism in Ireland and Israeli settler colonialism in Palestine.
Well, the thing which impresses me and impressed me when I first came across this parallel was the way in which settler colonialism in Ireland almost exactly parallels settler colonialism in Palestine. Mm. And what I mean by that in particular is the way in which the settlers are compelled to see the natives as inferior. Mm. And they're compelled to dream up fantasies about them being terrorists or into some kind of fanatical religion, whether it's Catholicism on the one hand or Islam on the other. And of course, the response in some ways is very similar. You see the resistance, the armed resistance in Ireland and indeed in Palestine, even at the cultural level. In the 1980s, with the emergence of Sinn Féin as a Republican movement and popular political expression, there was the idea of the Republican beard. These Irish people, they were a bit strange. They had beards. Mm-hmm. And of course, you see the same, of course, with Muslims today. So even down to that level, there's a very close parallel between settler colonialism in Ireland and in Israel, in particular because it has to be racist against the natives.
Mm. Of course, you know, we often hear, don't we, from Israel apologists claiming that Israel promotes women's rights. But we've just heard, haven't we, on the VT there, that Palestinian women, you spoke about it, you know, had to go on hunger strike to obtain sanitary supplies in Israeli jails. I mean, you know, in reality, what does that actually say about Israel's commitments to women's rights?
Well, I mean, it means that they don't have any such commitments. I mean, the women's rights is used to wash the reputation of Israel, just as gay rights is used, mm. and just as other other forms of oppression. They try and pose as if they're liberal and understanding, but when it comes to treating the natives, just as it was in Ireland, then the natives will be suppressed and the harshest techniques will be used. I mean, you mentioned about the United Nations saying inhuman and degrading treatment. Of course, that's a euphemism for torture. And it was a euphemism which was given in the Irish case, when in fact what was happening was torture. And what we see against the Palestinians today is torture. We should be clear about that. But what we see at the international level is a failure to fully face up to the brutality of the occupation.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that we're going to have to leave it there for today, as we're right out of time again. I want to thank our guest, Yousef Al-Halou, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam quotes Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stating, "Leave companionship with the tattlers because he or she will cause sedition among you and others." Imam Sadiq alayhi salam here in this hadith is referring to a very important point, and that is the negative effects of tattling and gossip in the life of the people. In better words, a tattler will cause fire in the life of the people.
لذا خیلی انسان باید مراقب باشد.
Therefore, we must be very much careful about the people we accompany or befriend in our life. The blessings of Allah will pour down into our life if we accompany good ones, and the blessings will be missed if we accompany corrupt people. Thus, many great people in their last words to their offspring always warn them about friends they select in their life. As a result, do not befriend the people who are corrupt or work in a corrupt place. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir,
Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
At least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assault on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Truthout wrote in this regard, more concerning, if expected, is the U.S. officials' clear refusal to acknowledge that the Israeli regime sparked this latest escalation and has continued to pour fuel over the fire. The U.S. State Department spokesperson, Vedant Patel, was confronted by Palestinian journalist Saeed Arigat on this question. Notably, right before Arigat spoke, Matthew Lee of the Associated Press expressed his exasperation with Patel, prefacing his own questions about the Zionist regime by declaring that he didn't expect Patel to respond with any substance. Arigat asked if the U.S. State Department had any comment on the fact that Israelis broke a ceasefire and killed children in the middle of the night while they were sleeping. Patel's response was every bit as dissembling and empty as Lee had anticipated. Patel said, "We continue to call on both sides to take steps that will not incite tensions and further incite violence. We have continued to call on both sides, on our Israeli partners and the Palestinian Authority, to continue to take prudent steps to ensure that the loss of civilian life is prevented and that steps are taken to ensure that violence is reduced and these kind of events don't happen. That is exactly why we continue to pursue our efforts for a two-state solution and continue to pursue our efforts for equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom," Patel claimed. Patel's comments clearly indicate the lack of value the Biden administration places on Palestinian life. At this point, the mantra of two-state solution is a strong indicator of a total absence of any desire to protect the rights or the lives of Palestinians, given that only the most delusional or willfully dishonest can even pretend to put it forth as a viable solution anymore. But the additional Biden talking point of equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom is an even stronger indication of having nothing to offer. But even beyond those indicators, Patel gave away the game when discussing who the Biden administration claimed to work with. Their Israeli partners have made it quite clear they don't take Biden at all seriously and, with good reason, expect him to dutifully support them with money and diplomatic help, regardless of their actions. The bankruptcy of the American position and the impotence of the Biden administration are reflected as much in the current state of play as they were at the beginning. When Blinken met with Israeli regime Foreign Minister Cohen, the readout of their call stated that the secretary noted the importance of recent meetings in Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh aimed at de-escalating tensions and urged that both Israel and the Palestinian Authority take additional steps to stabilize the situation in the West Bank and promote a durable calm. That was just days after Khazar Adnan's death and mere hours before the Israeli regime broke the ceasefire and launched this assault on Gaza. The irony is that the agreements at Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh, both of which the Zionist regime publicly and clearly abrogated almost immediately after they were announced, committed neither Israeli regime nor the United States to any significant steps to ease Palestinian suffering, but did commit the PA to restore security cooperation with Israel and to take steps in Palestinian cities like Nablus and Jenin to crack down on new and popular groups. In other words, they were both agreements to escalate confrontation, human rights abuses, and violence. It's long been a cliché to talk about how the U.S. regime makes this already vexing crisis worse through its dishonest behavior and defiance of all ethical, legal, and even pragmatic considerations in its support of the fabricated regime of Israel. But 75 years after the Nakba and the Zionist regime's creation, the Biden administration seems determined to top all its predecessors in trampling the rights and hopes of the Palestinian people.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, we have many issues when it comes to be parenting, and children also face a lot of issues. For example, when they are kids, especially I have a seven-year-old who, whenever he goes outside and then after half an hour, he'll come crying home. And when I'll ask what happened, and he'll say, like, that person said this, this person said this, that boy said this, this girl said this. And he's not able to manage things, or I can say simply, not able to defend himself. So can you actually today help me as a mother to deal with my child, how I can help him defend himself when he is out in the society or playing in the playground with other kids?
Yes, that's something which we all face in early days of our lives. And we are also being bullied by people of an elder age, or even by peers who may be stronger as far as their in their maybe bodies. They are, you know, bullies. So we have situations where we, our children find themselves in an awkward place where they need to defend themselves. So the most important thing is we need to make them feel brave. They need to become brave people. And we need to make them understand what bravery and courage is.
All right.
As we know that courage and bravery is an attribute of our souls, of our inner spirit in our souls, where this equilibrium is developed in the feelings which we have. One of the most important feelings which we have is the instinctive feeling of anger that is there.
Yeah.
Being brave and courage is controlling that anger.
Okay.
It's not being, it's to be being offensive. It's not being, courage is not being something who is able to, you know, hit back.
Yeah.
And it's not being something, it's not that you need to be rude to someone.
Right. So when we are actually teaching our child not to, how to defend himself, the first point that you're trying to clear over here is that if someone outside was rude with him, my child should not be rude. His behavior should not be like, he should be defending himself when courage comes in. But his courage does not mean that he also uses that violent behavior, or he also is rude or like starts hitting someone.
Exactly. It should be mostly because of self-defense. If there is any physical contact also, it should be because of self-defense, not of hurting the other person. So number one, bravery and courage, when we see in the life of Mawla Ali alayhi salam, when he is on the day of the battle of Khandaq.
All right.
When the enemy, when the foe comes and challenges all the Muslims to come and fight with him, and they have created this big ditch around Medina, and the Amr ibn Abdiwad, even with his horse, flies over to their side and challenges them and confronts them. Now Mawla Ali comes and answers his call to fight,
okay.
His invitation to fight.
All right.
And there we see that he is quite a strong enemy, a strong foe. But eventually, Mawla Ali is able to push him down
All right.
to the floor. And he's he's now fallen to the ground, and he can't defend himself, and he carries out a very offensive thing.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story, and yes, we would want to listen that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi. And Professor is teaching us actually when our children face some unusual behavior outside their home, how should they be defending themselves? Professor, you were telling us a very beautiful story about Imam Ali al-Islam, that once he gets attacked by the enemy and now Imam Ali al-Islam gets dominant over him. Now what happens?
So there's an unfortunate thing happening. He spits in the face of Mawla Ali. And it's just about when Mawla Ali is going to, you know, kill him and chop off his head maybe. But then Mawla Ali stands up and does not kill him at that instant. So it does not seem to be a reaction, an angry reaction to the misdeed of that person.
Yeah.
He stands up, takes a brief walk and a breath, and then comes back, and then he kills him. What do we learn from this? And what did Mawla Ali say after that? He said, I did not want to
make this war personal.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I don't believe that Mawla Ali, with his so great deal of magnanimity that he had, he would even feel, angry. He had full control of his anger. It was just to show people as a lesson that don't do anything which may even feel seem to be of a personal nature. It is for the sake of Allah, it is for the sake of Islam. So number one, everything which our children do, they should realize is for the sake of Allah, it is because of Allah. And Allah has commanded us to defend ourselves. He has commanded us to defend our dignity. He has asked us to defend and protect our bodies, of our personal belongings, and ourselves.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anyone to be offensive to us, to harm us, to injure us, to rob us of our personal wealth and belonging. It is the duty, it is the command of Allah to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
So we should be, if there's a conflict, and if we are being bullied, and if someone is, you know, trying to harm us, so we need to realize that we need to keep our temper, control our temper. We shouldn't let it become a personal thing. It should be for the sake of Allah. It should be because Allah has commanded us to defend ourselves.
All right.
And then we need to control our temper. The greatest valor and courage is controlling temper.
All right.
And that is what we find in the lifestyle of the Prophet and the Imams.
Imams, right. So you're telling actually the way we can actually teach our children not to be rude when it comes to dealing with others who offend them, we got to be learning from the lives of Prophet, peace be upon him, and Imams. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Professor Salman Akhavi discussing something very important, that when a child faces a situation in the society, in the playground, with his friends, where his friends are rude towards him, or sometimes they hit, sometimes they actually use a rude language, how does your child behave? How you got to be actually working on your child to behave in that kind of society? So yes, Professor, do we have some more tips?
Yes, so we need to understand that when they want to defend themselves, they need to keep their temper. They should not be offensive. They should not be rude. They should not hit back just because of the fact they need to be hitting back. It shouldn't be a brick for a stone, maybe. It should be for the sake of personal defense, just to keep ourselves away from harm. So we need to, teach our children personal defense, self-defense, as a, from their early childhood.
Yeah.
We should send them to, even girls should go to classes.
For self-defense.
Of self-defense.
Yeah. But sometimes when kids are of a very tender age, like, for example, I remember sitting in a gathering where there were these 70-year-old boys who were going to the school, and then one of the boys had beaten the seniors at school with his water bottle. And then when he was asked at home why, and he replies that these senior boys were not letting me go into the playground or play everywhere. And then when parents can actually inquire about the entire situation, the situation is that the senior students are authorized to maintain discipline at the school, and they are not they have to be taking control, that they do not allow each and every student to be coming into the ground. But this newcomer child does not know that these are the seniors and they're teaching me rules. So this child does not have the capability to actually receive that orders from seniors. So what do we do with such children?
Yes, of course. Especially at home, when they've been taught to take care of some rules and regulations, then when they go into the school, sometimes the way the seniors treat the young ones who are coming in, they have a very unfortunate way of doing it.
Yeah.
They have a very wrong way of doing it. Sometimes it happens, especially in cadet schools, in army schools. The seniors who want to welcome the juniors, they do carry out things which are very, very repugnant. Sometimes it has led to the deaths of new cadets also, unfortunately. It has happened over the
time.
The past. But yes, but they should be, number one, self-defense. Number two, a child from the beginning should be able to
accept the rules.
Accept the rules. Number three, should be able to work in teams and groups.
Okay.
That is important. We need to teach our children to become good team workers.
All right.
So, and we need to make our children say no.
Say no.
Confidently.
Well, that needs more discussion, and we will discuss that with you in another episode. So what is important over here is that we got to be teaching our children rudeness is not to be answered with rudeness always, and work in teams, work in groups, and accept rules, accept laws, accept discipline, and that they will accept only when we as parents will have some rules and discipline at home. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.